Hello and welcome to The Americano Show, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. In each episode of this very brilliant show, we will bring you one very well-informed expert, guest, or possibly two, depending on how we're feeling, and together we will try and get to the bottom of what is going on in the United States. We are doing a US election special event at the Emanuel Center in central London on October the 24th. And I almost don't need to do this announcement because tickets are selling so fast. But I want Americano listeners to take advantage of this opportunity and to get themselves a ticket. The special guest, who I wasn't allowed to announce before, is Nigel Farage, the leader of the Reform Party, a friend, I think we can say, of Donald Trump. And so I will be asking him about Trump and about the 2024 election and about the transatlantic relationship that Reform have with the Republican Party. Do come. We'd like to see you. I'm delighted to be joined today by Michael Kazin, who is a professor of history at Georgetown University. And we're going to be talking about the creaky old system that is the Electoral College, because I think it's fair to say a lot of people in America think that the Electoral College, which is how America elects its presidents, the mechanism by which it elects its presidents, is defunct, out of date, and needs to be reformed. Michael, I believe you think this, you feel this quite strongly. Can you explain to Americano listeners who might not be up to speed, we have quite a few British listeners, why the Electoral College, or how the Electoral College works, first of all, and why it is out of date?
Well, it works simply, if not well. Every state gets at least three electoral votes, two for its two senators, one for the minimum of members of the House of Representatives. And that's true for District of Columbia, where I live as well, which is not a state. But ever since the constitutional amendment was passed about 60 years ago, D.C. also gets three electoral votes. And then you get as many votes altogether as you have representatives in the House of Representatives, the lower house of Congress. So California has in the 50s, I forget exactly how many, but Wyoming only has three, D.C. only has three. A few other states only have three. That's the minimum as well. And so you don't get elected president by winning a majority of the popular vote. You get elected president by winning a majority of the electoral vote, which is 270. And there are actually two states, Maine and Nebraska, which award the electoral votes as a whole to whoever wins that state. But they also award one electoral vote to each candidate who wins each district, congressional district. So this election, for example, is very likely that Kamala Harris will win one electoral vote in Nebraska, which is a district around Omaha, which is the only really Democratic part of the state. And Donald Trump will probably win one electoral vote from Maine, in northern Maine, which is a very rural district and mostly white. But other than that, you win the whole state. And in California, which has many millions of people, If there was a nuclear attack on California and only three people were left and two voted for Donald Trump and one voted for Kamala Harris, then Donald Trump would win all the electoral votes of California. So that gives you an idea of why I think it's defunct, because, well, we're supposed to be a democratic country. And in a democratic country, I believe the majority should rule. If a majority of Americans vote for one candidate as opposed to another one, that candidate should win and should be president.
Well, yes, we'll get on to the democracy point in a second. But just on that Nebraska point, we did a few weeks ago do a podcast on what would happen if there's a contingent election. Because I think as things pan out, if Kamala Harris were to win all the Rust Belt states, all the battleground Rust Belt states, and Donald Trump were to win all the Southern Sun Belt states, and then let's say Trump somehow, he's not going to, but somehow won that Nebraska blue dot, you would have a tied Electoral College, which is an extraordinary thing to happen. So are you concerned that not only is Electoral College unfair, it also just is fraught with danger? Because if you did have a contingent election with a tied Electoral College, the uproar that would ensue after what happens, which it would go to the House of Representatives. Trump, I think, as things stand, would probably win then. And there would be bedlam, possibly even civil war.
I don't think there'd be civil war. I think our institutions are not as badly in crisis as they were, say, in 1861, the only civil war we had, luckily. But it's true that according to the 12th Amendment, which was ratified in 1804, not very recently, when if the electoral vote is tied, or I should say, if no candidate wins the electoral vote, of course, we could have more than two candidates winning electoral votes. That's happened before in American history. But if it's tied, then it goes to the House of Representatives, as you said. And then the system of electing the president is even more undemocratic because what would happen is every state gets one vote. Every state in the House of Representatives gets one vote, no matter how many, no matter what its population is. So Wyoming would get one vote, and so would California. New York State would get one vote, and so would Alaska, for example. So that means that whichever party has a majority of the contingent of its, of that party in that state in the House of Representatives, its delegation in the House of Representatives would vote for the candidate of their party. And that's only happened once before in American history in 1824, and it elected a candidate, John Quincy Adams, who had lost the popular vote, but there were several candidates that year, and so he could claim that, well, he was as much a valid winner as the one who did win the majority of the votes, who was Andrew Jackson. Excuse me, a plurality of the votes, who was Andrew Jackson.
I think I am instinctively a fogeyish reactionary, so I tend to like creaky old systems. And, you know, in Britain, we have a big row about first past the post going on because we've recently had an election where Labour won a huge majority, even though it didn't actually win that much of the popular vote. So that's been coming up again. And now you hear Conservatives, because it's not suiting them or it's not working for them. Now you hear Conservatives suddenly very anti first past the post. Isn't the thing here that really Democrats don't like the Electoral College because it doesn't give them the advantage that they feel they should have?
Well, that's true right now, but it hasn't always been true. For example, in the early 1970s, the House of Representatives, which had a lot of, you know, which was controlled by Democrats, had a lot of Republicans in it, though, voted for a constitutional amendment, which you need two-thirds margin to abolish the Electoral College. And the Senate would have as well if a group of Southern Democrats, like Strom Thurmond, the famous Dixiecrat, had not filibustered it. And Richard Nixon, the Republican president, was in favor of it, though presidents have no role in passing constitutional amendments. And why that happened is because in 1968, George Wallace, a Southern racist populist, won several electoral votes in the South, where he was very popular, and looked like he might win more in the North, actually, for a while. And both parties were, majorities of both parties were afraid that if that happened again, the election would have been thrown to the House of Representatives with the three candidates, as I mentioned before, or more candidates, nobody winning majority of the popular of the Electoral College vote, and that would have been chaos. And they wanted to avoid that. So the Electoral College was almost abolished, at least by Congress, and probably enough states, three quarters of the states probably would have ratified that amendment, but it didn't happen. So it really depends which party, of course, as you say, is most opposed to the Electoral College when it looks like it's disadvantaged by it. That's quite true.
And is it fair to say that America is a republic, not a democracy? And that should be kept in mind when discussing this subject.
Well, it depends how you define democracy, doesn't it? If you find democracy as the majority of adults, or all adults, I should say, have the right to vote, all citizens have the right to vote, we are a democracy. Have not been, probably not been a democracy until 1965, actually, when the Voting Rights Act was passed, because so many African-Americans in the South could not vote, even though they had the right to vote by a constitutional amendment, but they were prohibited for various nefarious Jim Crow methods. So I think that makes us a democracy in that sense. But in terms of the Electoral College, you know, I think we're less for democracy. And also the Senate is by that, by definition of, you know, if majority rules, well, clearly for a while now, Democrats have won a majority of all votes for the Senate nationwide, but they they control the Senate now. They will not control the Senate probably after this election. And that's because the small states are able to control it because every state gets two senators, no matter what its population. So it's mixed. I would say the Supreme Court is clearly not a democratic institution. It's not supposed to be a democratic institution. Federal courts, of course, are appointed by a democratically elected president, but and have to be confirmed by the Senate. But they're there for life, and they don't have to run for office the way in many states state Supreme Court justices have to. So it's a mixed system, I'd say, in terms of democracy. Now, of course, it's not a direct democracy. We're not an Owenite socialist colony, as in the 1830s and 40s, and we're not at the same time, a city state. There's not direct democracy, but then no serious large country is that kind of society and has ever been, really.
But is that what you would like? I mean, do you think direct democracy would be better?
I think democracy. I think electoral college, which is I like electoral college, which is actually decided by congressional district. I think that would be, first of all, it would force each major party candidate for president to campaign in parts of the country that even bother campaigning now. Because, say, in Colorado, which is now a very blue state, there are still Republican districts, and there'd be a possibility of Democrats winning some of those districts, and also they wouldn't win the whole state either. California has some Republican congresspeople as well. So, in that sense, it'd be more of a, let us say, the presidential election would really be a nationwide election, which not right now it's not, as your listeners probably know. Seven states, most people argue, will decide the election. Sometimes it's fewer than that. Sometimes it's more than that. But that, I think, is not a good situation because it leaves people in those other states feeling like the election's not really about them. There's less enthusiasm. There's less involvement. There's less discussion about politics, most likely. So I think I would like to have the, if we can't have abolish the Electoral College, have a pure popular vote, which we probably can't in the current situation politically, I'd like to have the election for president decided by each congressional district getting one electoral vote.
Do you think it's a kind of right-wing canard to say, well, Democrats like to move towards, popular vote, direct democracy because they can bring in an enormous number of immigrants, legally or illegally, and they know that they can win most of those votes, and therefore it's not necessarily you're not dealing with a stable population. You're dealing with a population that you can change, and therefore you can change the vote through changing the population.
Well, if you're a citizen of the United States, you can vote, and that's true for immigrants as well as people who've been here, whose family's been here for many generations. There's no evidence that I've seen any kind of credible evidence that non-citizens are voting, and certainly if Donald Trump's Republicans could have found such evidence, they would be, and it's credible, they're blasting it everywhere. They accuse Democrats of doing that, but I've seen no credible evidence at all. Now, Matt, there's probably, maybe a dozen non-citizens who manage to vote somehow. Often they get caught for doing it, and they actually can go to jail for trying to do that. I've seen no evidence of that. And also, immigrants now, as you've probably seen, Latino immigrants in Florida and Texas, for example, are trending more towards Republicans than they ever have. If you're a Cuban American immigrant in Florida, Republicans want you to vote very much so. Same as if you're, say, a Mexican American immigrant who's a border guard in Texas because your union has endorsed Donald Trump. So I think it's, the question of immigration, as I'm sure you know, has been a fraught issue in America forever because we are an immigrant country, both immigrants who came here of their own accord and, of course, African Americans who came here coerced. And Because of that, there's always been a battle to say, well, is immigration good or bad? Is it helping the country or isn't it? Which immigrant groups are we talking about? 100 years ago, exactly, Republican Congress passed and a Republican president, Calvin Coolidge, signed the most restrictive immigration law in American history, which basically banned almost all immigrants from Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, and East Asia. But ironically, this had a very ironic impact because that meant that immigration was less of a big issue, which had been helping Republicans. Then the Great Depression happens in 1929, 1930. 1932 election and 1936 election, many of the sons and daughters of those immigrants who had been whose family members have been banned from coming to the country become Democrats and vote very strongly for Franklin Roosevelt and other Democrats who control Congress and the presidency for several decades after that. So anti-immigrant sentiment can help a party for a while, but it can also hurt it because it tends to Americanize. When you cut off immigration, it tends to Americanize the voting public, and then people don't vote so much on their feelings about immigrants, but more about what's going on in the economy, what's going on in American culture.
But forgive me if I didn't quite follow what your preferred system would be. But you're in reforming the Electoral College. I suppose the concern would be that you would move into a situation where California, rather than having not as much of a say as perhaps it should have based on its population, has far too much of a say. Would your system, your preferred system, stop that happening?
Well, this is true to a degree. I mean, California still has, I think, 56 congresspeople, whereas, of course, Wyoming only has one.
And it has a huge number of, it has the largest number in the Electoral College, right? The number
Yes,
of, so,
exactly,
yeah.
exactly. So there would still be more electoral votes coming from California, but perhaps 20 of them would be Republican votes. Only 36 would be Democratic votes. Whereas in some places, like say Alabama, where black citizens vote Democratic, and almost all white citizens, not all, but most of the white citizens vote Republican, Democrats would pick up one or two electoral votes in Alabama, and Republicans would get most of them. So, as I said, it would be really a national election, a competitive national election, in a way it's not now. And also, it would be, in a sense, more like a parliamentary system in the way that, because each parliamentary seat, each congressional seat, we'd get one vote. And we would give, I think it would give the battles for Congress, a more meaning as well. And a lot of times, what decides, especially in recent years, what decides who has a majority in the House of Representatives is a few swing districts in various states. And if you had presidential candidates campaigning in those areas to win that electoral vote in that district, as well as for their candidate of their party to win that congressional seat, that would be make a very interesting, relentless, perhaps more exhaustive campaign. A lot harder to for reporters to cover as well, because they'd have to go to a lot of places all around the country, whereas now they can just hang out in the around the Great Lakes and in Georgia and Arizona.
Yeah, I suppose then as you rightly say, there are seven states now that are, the focus, the battleground states, and they change slowly. But might it be a good thing that they change slowly rather than hyperactively? It might be, Ohio, for instance, was a key battleground state, and it no longer is, and so it's no longer the sort of the focus of campaign efforts, and now it's more Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania. Might that be a good gradual thing?
Sure. I'm not in favor of rapid change in terms of electoral leanings necessarily. Sometimes they've happened, of course, and that they've been some of the times when American politics has changed in ways that it changed to a form where it continues to embody for many years. That happened in the 1890s when Republicans became a majority party and flipped a lot of states in the Midwest, which had been swing states, become Republican states. And it happened, as I mentioned, in the 1930s too, where states that had been swing states also in the Midwest and some degree out west as well. Became solidly Democratic states. And of course, it happened in the 70s and early 80s when the South became, most Southern states became more Republican than had always been Democratic since the Civil War.
Well, as you've rightly said, there have been various attempts, Republican and Democrat, to change the system, but it never happens. What realistic chance do you think there is of the Electoral College being disbanded, reformed, overhauled?
Not very optimistic about it, to be honest with you. I think it would take a shock, such as a serious third party candidate who won electoral votes, to scare both parties. Democrats, Republicans are very badly divided now, as you know. People are very partisan. A lot of people say they like third parties, but in the end, people are used to the system. And unlike in Britain, where you have third parties do, crop up and have cropped up in recent years, here, the only third parties we have right now are fairly marginal third parties: Libertarians, Green Party, a few others you hardly even know the name of, they hardly get any votes. And it's only third parties only matter here usually when a famous individual, decides to run, like Ross Perot did in 1992, 1996, has a lot of money. Or George Wallace, who was already well known by the time he ran in 1968, independent campaign. So usually it's the individual who matters, not the third party itself. So unless that happens again, and I don't see it happening in the near future, I think it's not going to happen because we are such a divided country, and neither party wants to take the risk of shaking up that system in a way that could help the other side. And also, there's just not the votes because of the filibuster. You need 60 votes to change it. And right now, there's no realistic possibility of either party getting 60 votes in the Senate, not this year and probably not next year either. I don't know about the future. But again, the great thing about being a historian is you can't predict the future. Things happen, contingency matters. And there could be a tumultuous, chaotic event or a series of events in the US or in the world, which changes that calculation. But right now, I don't see it.
Do you think it is necessarily a healthier thing for a democracy to have more successful candidates or parties, third party, independent, and so on? Or is there a good argument that having two behemoth parties is actually quite beneficial because they respond to the electorate themselves and they change and they adapt? Whereas in countries where you have multi-party democracies, the gridlock happens at the legislative level.
No, it's a great question. Let me think. Well, of course, it's hard to answer the question without bringing in my own views of what I think should happen in the country.
Well, that's what we want. We want to hear.
For example, right now, I'd be very happy if there were a breakaway from the Republican Party that was that was running and would take electoral votes away from Donald Trump because Democrats would win. And likewise, if I were a Republican, I'd be very happy if, say, Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, instead of getting 1% of the vote, would be able to get 8% or 9% of the vote and would win electoral votes in some states, because then Donald Trump would have a much better chance of being elected. But, I think there is, as you say, something certainly to be said for the way in which two major parties have to respond to or co-opt the views of people in social movements, of those who've left the party unhappy, and party has to respond to them to bring them back, because you do have to win this majority in the Electoral College, a majority in both houses of Congress. Same time, third parties have had an important impact in American history at times. They have brought up issues that two parties have to respond to in a way that really more powerfully, I think, than just people just leaving the party and going to the other party have. For example, the People's Party in the 1890s, which I've written about, was basically a social democratic party. It was a party mostly of farmers, small farmers, but had a lot of wage earners as well. And it stood for an income tax, a progressive income tax. It stood for government ownership of the railroads. It stood for basically a social democratic program before that term was really used. And it helped to transform a Democratic Party, because William Jennings Bryan, who ran for president in 1896, was not a populist with a capital P, but he was very friendly with populists in his own state of Nebraska. And he took over, and he and the Populist Party in 1896 did support him for president. And a lot of populist, small P populist ideas began to infuse the Democratic Party. And also there were pro-populist Republicans too, who were especially in the mountain states, like Colorado and Idaho, who also had a felt pushed by the fact they were afraid of losing votes to that party if they didn't adopt some of its programs. I think that's that, that. So that's one example where it has mattered. Also, Ross Perot, I think, had an impact probably on Donald Trump and others who opposed the North American Free Trade Agreement, which Bill Clinton, of course, pushed very hard to pass in his first term in the 1990s. And the whole argument about foreign trade, about tariffs that we're having in this country right now, and we've had off and on for the last few decades. Ross Perot really helped put that argument into public discourse in a way. If he had not run as a third party candidate, who at one point seemed like he was going to actually get more votes than George H.W. Bush, the incumbent president. Of course, he didn't. But that, I think, so third parties can have a very important impact. The great historian Richard Hofstadter has a great line in one of his books. He said that in America, third parties are like honeybees. They sting and then they die. So the sting has had an important impact, I think, on I don't want to continue the metaphor, but to get each party to give each party a jolt and give each party a reason to fear that it will lose many, many votes if it doesn't adopt some of the ideas of that third party.
Well, it's very good to hear a Hofstadter quote that isn't the paranoid style in American politics. But thank you very much, Michael, for coming in. That's absolutely fascinating. Perhaps we can speak again when the Electoral College has had another meltdown after November 5th.
I don't expect that to happen, actually, to be honest with you. I know I'm among people, I'm on the left, obviously, as you know, but like most people on the left, unlike most people on the left, I'm not afraid our institutions are so weak, you know. Electoral College is pretty strong, and I think the courts are too. So I'm not afraid of civil war, you know. I think civil war was closer in the late 1960s than it is now in many ways. There's a lot more violence then as well. So now the violence is mostly rhetorical. So.
I think that's probably right. Natasha and I were in Chicago, and we were looking forward to some proper unrest, and we saw barely any.
Well, I was arrested in 68 at the convention, so.
Oh, right. Do tell us a bit about that, actually. Were you put in jail?
Yes, I was.
For how long?
Oh, just 2 nights.
Was it about Vietnam? Was that what you were?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I went there as a young radical. I was a member of a group called Students for Democratic Society, the leading white New Left group at the time. You might have heard of it. And I went to Chicago. I was living in Cambridge. I was at Harvard at the time, and we were going to try to convince these young liberals who were supporting Eugene McCarthy to give up on the Democratic Party, on the war party. And I got arrested. Actually, I could have been arrested for breaking windows in downtown Chicago, but the police didn't see me do that. But they did see me walking out of a park where some demonstrators were trying to sleep with a young woman I just met. And I was wearing an SDS button, and they arrested me for that. but obviously, since I committed no crime, I was later on released on my own recognizance, and the charges were dropped. But I was in jail for 2 days, you know, in Cook County, Chicago.
Wow. So you were a yippie.
No, oh, no, no, no. I was a radical. I was different.
You were
the
radical.
The yippies.
The yippies were the Eugene McCarthy guys.
No, 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 no. I've got to teach you some 60s history. the yippies were a group called that was put together by hippie leftists. Yes, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, some other people like that in New York City. They actually founded the organization. It was really, you know, never an organization. They called it the yippies because they had to have some name. It stood for the Youth International Party, but it was never international or party. They actually got the name because they were taking LSD one night and they were jumping around the room and talking about how they would try to stop the war in Vietnam. And they started going, yippee, 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 yippee. And they said, oh, that's a good name for an organization. So they called themselves the Yippies. And and they went to Chicago. They were one of the groups that went to Chicago to disrupt the convention. But they nominated a pig for president. They called him Pigasus. They knew a little Latin, I guess. And Pigasus, you know, calling a pig, of course, then, you know, people on the left called police pigs, unfortunate term, but nevertheless, that was the term. They said they were going to put LSD in the water supply of Chicago, so forth. It was mostly, they were a sort of a left-wing performance group, in effect.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't a yippie. I was a serious radical. I wanted to, you know, I wanted people to read Marx and learn about imperialism. And I was in favor of having fun, but not in public.
Well, that's the only kind of radical we like to have on the Americano podcast. Yippieism is coming back to me now. Thank you very much for the reminder, though. And please come on again. Thank you very much for listening to that episode of the Americano show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave rave reviews on whatever platform you listen to it on. I would like to thank, of course, my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows. Thanks again for listening. All the best.